The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Chairman Mike Gallagher is the head of the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. Is Representative Gallagher from Wisconsin. And before I get into the substance of China, I just want to say, Chairman Gallagher, the Browns are doing everything they can to help Aaron Rodgers get out of Wisconsin. They just traded their 42nd round pick, their 42nd pick in the upcoming draft to the Jets for Elijah Moore, so that the Jets have more. They just want to help Aaron Rodgers. They're negotiating with hostage takers. The Packers are hostage takers. When will they let Aaron Rodgers go?
Well, reports are that the talks are moving in the right direction. We don't know if it's going to be 2 second round picks, a first round pick, a second round, but I'm confident that this deal will get consummated in the very near future, Hugh.
And you realize this is the Browns helping. The Browns are helping you out. We are giving the draft capital. We just did that for you. So I just want you to remember, I have David Joyce coming on later today. I need you to go over and thank Congressman Joyce today for the Browns' help to the Packers to help them get Rodgers ransomed. Mr. Chairman, I want to read you two things from this morning's Ellis Items. Do you get Ellis Items? Do you read John Ellis Items, news items every morning?
I do get Ellis Items. That's exceptional.
It is exceptional. Today is first two items, both having to do with Xi. The first comes from John Pomfret and Matt Pottinger. I believe Pottinger was one of your first witnesses. Chinese leader Xi Jinping says he is preparing for war. At the annual meeting of China's parliament and its top political advisory in March, Xi wove the theme of war readiness through four separate speeches, in one instance telling his generals to dare to fight. Then we drop down to Orville Schell from the Hoover Institution. I don't think he's been before your committee yet. I think Xi is a pure Leninist. He has certain aspirations to reduce the inequalities in Chinese society, but his real focus is on building the wealth and power of the state. And he views party organization as the key to the goal. Lenin, too, was a party builder, in essence, repudiating the Deng approach. Do you agree with both that, preparing for war and party over people?
I do. First, let me say that John Pomfret wrote a phenomenal book about China and the United States called The Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom that I recommend to everybody who's interested in the subject. Oh. And yes, Matt Pottinger was our first part of our first hearing. And in his testimony, he gets at something that both he and Pomfret double down on in this piece, which is that Xi Jinping and other members of the Politburo say one thing to a Western audience, one thing that the denizens of Davos are desperate to believe, but they say an entirely different thing to other party members, to their populace. And Pottinger, in his testimony, talked about it as one of the great magic tricks of the modern era, and that Chairman Xi would actually agree on that point, because he refers to the party's propaganda and its influence activities, its united front work, as a magic weapon for advancing the regime's interests. And Pottinger went on to say, you could call the CCP the Harry Houdini of Marxist-Leninist regimes, the David Copperfield of communism, or the Chris Angel of autocracy. So I commend his testimony to everybody. And for a while now, Xi Jinping seems to be preparing his populace to endure enormous economic pain and sacrifice that would ensue if they got into a confrontation with the West. This is why the cult of the Korean War has become so popular in communist China, as an example of a moment when Mao risked everything to confront the West. And though the Chinese people had to endure great pain and sacrifice, they emerged as a great power on the world stage. So all of this is very concerning. This is why we need to do everything possible to enhance deterrence and help Taiwan defend itself. And I'm looking forward to joining Speaker McCarthy as we greet President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan next week.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I've got to get back to the Beltway to provide you comms advice on this committee, because we had a lot of attention to the first hearing, but we haven't had a second hearing yet, have we? Or if we did, I missed it.
We did have a second hearing on the Chinese Communist Party's ongoing Uyghur genocide. And though that day was consumed with the Energy and Commerce hearing about TikTok, the hearing was remarkable because we heard from two survivors from the concentration camps in China, horrific stories about forced sterilization, rape, the way in which children are treated in these concentration camps, which is sort of the largest ethno-religious incarceration since the Holocaust. It's unbelievable. And from that hearing emerged a variety of policy recommendations that we're going to be able to run with on the select committee. So we're finalizing our hearing schedule for the rest of the year. I would suspect our next hearing will turn attention to the issue of Taiwan. But our genocide hearing is available for everyone who wants to see it online. And I just would really commend the testimony of the survivors that we put in front of the committee, who are incredibly brave in sharing their stories.
I want to remind your excellent comms team, they've got to send that stuff out to me and to other people in little bite-sized bits, because we're dealing with Dwayne here. He's not going to win the spelling bee. We got to make it very easy to consume what this stuff is. I want to ask you about what Pottinger and Pomfret said. He's preparing for war. Now, that is going to shock a lot of Americans. You know, they spend $300 billion a year. We spend $800 billion, and they say, well, they're not catching up. They don't have to spend $800 billion. All they got to do is get Taiwan. We got to defend the world. So if you do a preparing for war hearing, I'll listen to all that. I think it will shock a lot of Americans, Mr. Chairman. I know you touched on it in the first hearing, but when Pomfret and Pottinger say preparing for war, we didn't listen to Hitler in the 30s. Right. We did not listen to it. If believe people what they say. And do you think that's true, that he's preparing for a war?
Well, I do. I don't think that it means necessarily that war is imminent. A lot depends on what we do. If we get our act together, as I believe we can with the right leadership in the United States, I think we can deter a war. But we have a tendency to mirror image. We have a tendency to assume that dictators like Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin play by the same rules or care about the same values that we in the West do. And if you examine the rhetoric of the Biden administration leading up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you'll see a lot of naive thinking, a lot of utopian assumptions about the fact that something like this couldn't happen in the modern era. And I fear a lot of the same naivety is guiding our view on China right now, which is why Pomfret and Pottinger's analysis is so important, because in essence, what they're saying is that we have to take what Xi Jinping says seriously. That if there's one lesson from Ukraine, is that when dictators tell you what they're going to do, we have to take them seriously. And repeatedly, Xi Jinping has said that he wants to reunify Taiwan with the mainland by force if necessary. It would be foolish to discount that possibility. Now, no doubt, he'd prefer to do it through non-kinetic or non-military means. He'd prefer to do it through what President Tsai of Taiwan calls cognitive warfare or political warfare or via economic coercion. But I think he's prepared to endure enormous pain and loss of life in order to secure his legacy as a paramount leader in the CCP pantheon on par with Mao. That's what we're dealing with here.
Now, Mr. Chairman, last question for you this morning. We have, I don't know if you can talk to the conference about this. I did cover the TikTok hearing extensively, and that was in Energy and Commerce, right? Because our friend Chairman McMorris Rogers was the chair, and we played that. Can we not stack important hearings on top of each other? I mean, we got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, even in a 3-day work week. Can we get the conference chair, go talk to Chairwoman Stefanik or to the speaker to say, if we're going to have three big hearings, let's do one on Tuesday, one on Wednesday, one on Thursday, or maybe you can get four in if you do one at nighttime, which I think is best. But do they ever talk about that, or does every chairman run off and do what they want to do?
Well, quite honestly, it is why we're doing our hearings at night, because there's no risk of overlapping with another hearing. Rarely are the hearings between committees deconflicted. So that's not a bad suggestion. It's something we could talk about as a conference.
Call it the Hewitt rule.
However,
it's the Hewitt rule. You don't bring on two guests You don't have two quarterbacks at the same time. You don't try and sell two products at the same time. You do one hearing at one time. The Hewitt rule. It's very easy. We can break that down for the people from Texas.
And the Hewitt-Gallagher rule is no acronyms and no jargon.
That's the Gallagher rule, and thus far you've lived up to it today. Yeah.
I think I take that point. However, I will say that day, which I don't remember if it was a Wednesday or a Thursday in Congress, not only did you have that TikTok hearing, which was a very bad day for TikTok, and you had Democrats and Republicans both expressing severe concerns about TikTok, not only did you have our hearing on the ongoing CCP genocide at night, you had the China Human Rights Commission doing an extensive hearing on CCP human rights abuses and United Front work, which was remarkable. It was 6 hours. It didn't get any attention at all, but there was a lot that happened. I ended that day thinking that we just witnessed a remarkable shift in the United States Congress in terms of our policy on the Chinese Communist Party, and it seemed like a wake-up call. But you're right. We should do more coordination across committees. There are ways in which, too, we can tackle the same issue but tease out different parts of it. We've thought on the Select Committee about looking at the TikTok issue and then kind of elevating it into this bigger question of our digital future, digital authoritarianism, all the other ways in which the CCP is trying to dominate the digital world and control the behavior of not only their own citizens, but export that model of total control around the world. So there's a way in which we can figure out how to deconflict hearings and all work together as a conference better.
Last question is political. It's got nothing to do with your substantive work. Wisconsin elects a Supreme Court justice next week. Soros and Pritzker just put $1 million into it. How important is it that Justice Kelly win?
Everything is on the line here in Wisconsin. Everything we've accomplished since 2010, the Walker reforms, we're getting outspent, outraised. The progressive candidate has been transparent with the Democratic base about what she's going to provide them if she gets the bench. She called the legislative maps absolutely positively rigged, foregoing any impartiality in future cases involving redistricting or abortion. They have billionaires in California bankrolling their TV ads. So we need all the help we can get in Wisconsin right now. This is absolutely critical, not just if you're a Wisconsin citizen, but if they can do this, if they can prove this model works, it's a playbook that they're going to use across the United States. And it's going to usher in a wave of progressive governance and effectively legislating from the bench that's incredibly destructive and chaotic for common sense Wisconsinites and Americans.
So everyone, get out and call your Badger buddies and talk slowly and say, Justice Kelly, Justice Kelly. In with Kelly, out with Rogers. Congressman, always good to see you, Mike Gallagher. Follow him on Twitter, Rep Gallagher. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The original Hugh Hewitt, at least the original Hugh Hewitt in Ohio, was judge of the Court of Common Pleas in Ashtabula County, and his law partner was Dave Dennison. Dave Dennison was the congressman, the last Republican congressman to represent Warren, Ohio. Now, because of redistricting, they have a new, I guess maybe we had, after Michael Kerwin, we might have had Lyle Williams for a while, but Charles Carney was there forever. And David Joyce is now the congressman representing Warren, Ohio. And he is the chair of the Subcommittee on Appropriations for Interior and the Environment, which means he can do things for Warren and Lake Erie. He's also really one of the nicest guys in the House of Representatives. Congressman Joyce, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Great to have you on.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be on, Hugh.
Tell me, Congressman, where did you go to high school? Because I just want to make sure you didn't go to St. John's.
No, I went to West Georgia.
Okay, West Geauga. And you didn't go to Ashtabula High School where my mom and dad went, and you're not a harbor guy. So West Geauga is fine. And then you went down to Dayton. You're a flyer, and you're a flyer out of law school. When did you decide to go into politics?
Well, when I first came home, I started working for the Republican Party in Geauga County, figuring I could use it to help meet some people and get some clients. And after working on a couple campaigns, there was a guy who was a prosecutor who was ran for muni court judge and won. And there was a process in which they were going to appoint somebody. And I looked around the room and I saw none of these people had ever been to an event before. I mean, well, I'm going to throw my name in. Next thing I know, I got appointed prosecuting attorney. And I enjoyed that job for 25 years.
And then from there, you ran for Congress. Did you ever dine at Lou's Steakhouse over at Saybrook?
No, I haven't, but thank
you. Oh, my goodness. You got to get to Billow Beach, Congressman. Anyway, You managed to get on appropriations. How did that happen? Was it a John Boehner helping out a fellow Buckeye early on in your career a decade ago?
Yes, it was, exactly. I mean, John always made sure that people, all the Buckeyes were on committees of jurisdiction. I surveyed the field and saw that my predecessor, Steve LaTourette, and Steve Austria, who lost in a primary to Mike Turner, were on appropriations and weren't coming back. And I said, you know, I thought I could do a good job there. He told me I'll never get it, but then he actually was helpful in pushing for it.
Well, that is great because 10 years. Warren had the undoubtedly memorable Jim Traficant, who was worthless as a congressman, and they had the no one remembers Charles Carney, who was a very good appropriator. You can either have a workhorse or a show horse. You're a workhorse. How do you like being chairman of a subcommittee that decides the Interior Department and the EPA and other? Don't you also have NEH and NEA?
Well, you know, I got bumped up this term, and I'm now the chair of Homeland Security.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and so I also got on defense, which is interesting. So,
oh, you're on with Ken Calvert on defense?
I'm learning a lot from Ken. I went to his office the other day to apologize because our homeland and defense bills are on a collision course, so I'm hardly making any of the hearings, but I just went with him to the Far East on a CODEL, and I could tell you one thing, Hugh. I listen to you, but I still got a lot to learn about defense.
Well, Chairman Calvert knows what he's doing, and he won't say it, but they got to start looking at transitioning away from the carriers. Talk to me about Homeland Security then. That means that Mayorkas was there recently, right? Is he in there for the budget request?
He's in this morning, as a matter of fact. Very timely. Yesterday we had the director from CISA and also from TSA, and then today he's coming in.
Are you going to talk to him about the fence, the wall, the border barriers that are absolutely necessary to send a signal? It's the outward manifestation of an inward resolve to control the border.
Yes, and the fact that we let all these contracts and we're paying the contractors to do nothing and letting the steel rot there on the ground just makes no sense. And the idea that we're going around talking about the border being secure is something that I think he needs to explain. As I've explained to the other members on the committee, though, what you got to say is, you know, you ask money for X, you have produced Y. Tell us what the discrepancy is. Why you're not solving these problems? Why aren't you doing the things that are necessary to secure our border?
That is a great line. We'll be listening for that exchange yesterday. You know, it was my bane to be in the Reagan administration when the appropriators had Steny Hoyer, and he would write fine line into the print for the OPM appropriations. Do you guys do appropriation writers anymore that say we're defunding this position or we're refusing to fund any effort to write these regulations? Do you do that anymore?
Absolutely. That's what we had been doing until the earmarks finally came back. The idea was that you could say you couldn't say how they were going to spend money, but you could say how they could not spend money. And so that reverse earmark was, I think, very important as far as limiting a lot of the regulation and especially the bad regulation that all these people try to write into their agencies. This afternoon, I'm also on financial services, and I got Gary Gensler.
Be on appropriations and financial services?
Well, financial services, general governance is a subcommittee of appropriations.
Okay. So I thought maybe you were talking about Patrick McHenry's committee, because that you can't be on one of the big three, two of the big three, right?
Correct. And so Patrick does a wonderful job there, but I'm on the one that we put in the things that if they're pushing regulation like Gensler's pushing, we put in no money will be applied to and put out the whatever rule or regulation he's trying to enforce.
Now that you are in a position, your lobbyist line, I'm not a lobbyist. I've never been a lobbyist. I went up and yelled at congressmen about the Endangered Species Act, but I've never been a lobbyist. What is it like to be on appropriations right now? They must be lined up in the hall since earmarks are back.
Well, you know, the good part is they have to be there's no longer any outside earmarks. It has to be a public agencies, and it has to be vetted through committee. And so they have to put them all out ahead of time, and then you're allowed to put in 15 of them. And so I tell people who are coming to me for things for Homeland or when I was Interior, say, give me your top three and make sure if we're going for number one, if we get it, you're done with two and three. Or you know, if we get two, try to prioritize them so we're not just going through them and filling them out and try to help the areas where you I think it's our duty to spend the money the way the representative sees fit versus just giving it in bunches to the administration and some bureaucrat who has no idea what Warren, Ohio looks like making determinations on how the money should be spent.
You know, I've now come to, I think we're at the happy medium on earmarks, what you just
described.
Let me bring up one. I'll lobby you. I know Ravenna wants the missile defense program. They've wanted it for years. The chamber from Northeastern Ohio in the Valley goes in and looks for it. Has that ever come across your screen on defense appropriations yet?
Oh, yeah. So we were fighting hard for that, and Michigan was trying to get it and a couple others. But we, you know, we didn't get it this time, but we're still, you know, fighting for Ravenna and also for the Youngstown Air Force Base that is also the considered the airport down in that area.
Well, all you have to do is write, no other appropriations shall be spent in Ohio except in northeastern Ohio. That's a pretty good one, right? Now, can we do something about the border between Pennsylvania and Ohio? Can we get the TSA to do that? We can shut down the Steelers fans sneaking over. So, honestly,
well,
you're part of the Main Street.
A lot of them in your hometown.
I know. My nephew is a Steelers fan. My brother failed. Let's talk a little bit about whether or not this Congress is going to get anything done. I just had Olivia Beavers on. She's a fine reporter from Politico.
Great.
Said there are tensions within the caucus. Expand on that, Congressman Joyce. Are there?
You know, it's a growing pain, but the one thing that a decade I've been here, we're finally starting to see, although the craziness that took place the 3rd through the 6th till Kevin was finally appointed, this is the first time we've had all the different factions at one table discussing how we're going to move the ball forward and get to 218. And that's a very important aspect of this that has been lost over the in the past. In working together, instead of having things come from the Speaker's office directly to the floor, working on doing our job in committees, doing our job as a whole to try to process the bills like and get to an agreement on what it's going to take to get the debt ceiling done and other things. And I think Kevin's made some tremendous progress there. But, you know, there are some growing pains in that.
Obviously, there are going to be growing pains in that. I just want the Main Street Caucus, of which you are a member, and I think I'd probably be a member of it, too, if I were a member of Congress, to get along with the Freedom Caucus. And then can't you do between the various caucuses what you just discussed among the various demands for appropriation? Give me your top three. Can't we satisfy every caucus in the Republican conference?
And that's what we're trying to get to, actually. And an amazing part of this is the other day they were talking, you know, we were trying to talk through the budget process, and they're what Kevin calls the five families, and I happen to be the chair of the Republican governance group. So I have a seat at the table. And as they got through with it all, I said, look, you guys, I appreciate what you're saying, but when you do a 10-year budget and you talk about the cuts that are going to be made, all the 10 members that Lee Zeldin brought to the table are all going to be out next time. They're all Biden districts that we won. You know, let's talk about this year. Let's talk about what it takes to get to 218 and keep the 218 assembled. And about 2 minutes later, Scott Perry goes, you know, I agree with Dave Joyce, the head of the Freedom Caucus. We got to make sure that we're making sure that our policy is consistent to bring everybody on board and get everybody through the next election, too, without messing with our own people.
Now, they're going to redistrict Ohio, Congressman, because the Ohio Supreme Court flipped and the maps that the legislature draw are going in. I hope you're going to keep Warren, because we haven't had an appropriator in a million years with seniority. Is that going to happen? You're going to keep Warren, whatever happens?
I sure hope so. You know, I've had lunch recently with Tim Ryan, who had been an appropriator.
Dear friend of mine, Kennedy High School graduate. Yep.
Yeah, and I sat down with him to make sure I wasn't dropping the ball down there. But great things are happening in Warren. Next time you come down in June for your golf outing or whenever you get down this summer, you know, it could bring you up to speed on some of the things that are happening. But part of my Far East visit, I met with the president of Taiwan, and Foxconn is taking over Lordstown and doing some great
investment
there. What? Yeah.
Oh, that is terrific. Are they going to make chips there?
No, what they're going to do is they've got the electric truck that they started, and they've got the battery factory, and right across the street, LG has a battery factory going on, and we're trying to rename the Mahoning Valley the E-Valley, and Youngstown State, there's a lot of buy-in on this and a lot of public support, but the president of Taiwan committed to this. I said, I know Foxconn had some stops and starts in Wisconsin, but you're asking for concessions in Ohio, and people aren't really amenable to doing that until they know you're going to put in the investment. She said, oh, you know, we want this. We've encouraged them to invest there.
Yeah, GM took the money and ran from Lordstown. I'm never going to forgive them for that. They took the money and ran. So, Congressman, when you look at your three counties, I think you have Geauga, Ashtabula, four, Geauga, Ashtabula, Mahoning, and Trumbull, is that right?
In Portage, five.
Oh, yeah, Portage. What is the number one priority for the, we cover the land. We're in Youngstown, we're in Cleveland, we're in Columbia, we cover the land. What's the most important thing?
Jobs. You know, making sure that we have the jobs and they're good paying and going to be there for a while.
Now, in Ashtabula, does the port have a future?
You know, I've been working for that. I've said that. That is one of the best kept secrets we have in the North Coast of America, because they have the deep water ports. They just hadn't been used. And I've been fighting for years to get the liquefied natural gas up there. Granted, it's only a 6 month a year it's available, but we could still direct ship to Hungary.
And, you know, there is a plan on the table to build or repair submarines in the Great Lakes again. I think it's further. I think it's not in Ashtabula, but further up the North Coast. Has that crossed your radar yet?
No, it hasn't. But thanks for the heads up on that. I'll look for it.
Okay, keep coming back. I'm so glad, Warren. You know, this is a homer. It's a complete hometown. Now, he is chairman of Homeland Security Appropriations Subcommittee, so it matters. But Congressman Dave Joyce, we love having you on. Keep coming back. Great representative for, you know, that's my hometown. Morning Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, bringing you all the news you need, the analysis you want, and a little bit of Browns news. Jim Garrity brings you all the news you need and the analysis you want in the Morning Jolt and the Washington Post and a little bit of Jets news. So let's begin with Jets-Browns news this morning. We gave you another choice, the 42nd draft choice, Jim, to help you pry away Aaron Rodgers from his hostage situation in Wisconsin. I just talked to Congressman Gallagher about this. Who's messing this up? Is it the Jets or the Packers?
I don't think either team feels that much pressure to get a deal done. It's not like Aaron Rodgers needs to be there in minicamp. It's not like he's inexperienced and he needs to know the offense. You're going to build the offense around him. He's been found almost after the near trade or the idea of the trade, after Rodgers said he wanted to go to the Jets, you saw Jets fans and Packers fans arguing about who has leverage. The correct answer is that, you know, neither one of them has enormous leverage over the other. The Packers want to start the Jordan Love era. So they know that they've got to get rid of Aaron Rodgers at some point. Apparently, Packers fans expect to get a number one draft choice. Now, the Packers GM said that's not necessarily a requirement of the deal. I don't think they're going to get one unless it's part of a conditional one based on how the Jets perform next year. One of those things where the Jets make it to the Super Bowl, you get a first-round draft choice. Make it to the playoffs, you get a second-round draft choice. You don't make it playoffs, it's a third-round draft choice. Maybe some other incentive based on does Rodgers play 1 year or 2 year or something like that. So all this stuff has got to get hammered out. But the Packers are going to get probably at least, you know, one draft choice this year. That's why you have the 2 second-round picks for the Jets. They're probably going to get a conditional one next year that could be a first-round pick. And you're probably going to see one other player thrown in there. Wide receiver Corey Davis seems like a likely candidate for that slot. So that's,
yeah, I want to suggest, do you do a podcast with anyone every week?
I do.
You need to invite Chairman Gallagher. He'll want to talk about China, right? But he is also deeply invested in this trade. And I would like to hear Garrity and Gallagher talk about the Jets and the Packers. I would listen to that. And given that the Browns are making it happen, thank you for Elijah Moore. That's what we needed. We need Elijah Moore, so I want to thank the Jets. Now I got to ask you a tougher question. You wrote a column for the Post. If the GOP ever tires of anger wars, Tim Scott would have a shot in 2024. Now, I want to explain, Jim and I are both in columns at the Post. We do not write our headlines. We write our columns, we do not write our headlines. And so I don't know if you intended it to have the anger wars in there, but I have in my hand a list of 12 Republicans who may yet run for the presidency. And I'm going to ask you to rank them in terms of happy to least happy. All right, Jim, this is putting the pressure. Here we go.
Happy about running?
Reagan happy warrior. Hubert Humphrey.
Okay. All right.
Ronald Reagan versus not happy, angry. We have Greg Abbott. Chris, this is alphabetical because I'm in Switzerland. They can all run. Yeah. And I don't care. Greg Abbott, Chris Christie, Ron DeSantis, Larry Elder, Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, Vivek Ramaswamy, Tim Scott, Chris Sununu, Donald Trump, and Glenn Youngkin. Who's the happiest of them all?
I'm going to guess Tim Scott, but there's strong competition up there.
Who's the strong competition?
One of the things I note is like almost all of them can be a happy warrior. It's a question, do you choose to run that way? And I think the antithesis of the happy warrior is Trump running around saying, I am your vengeance, I am your retribution. Showing the video of January 6th at the rally in Waco. I mean, like that's anti-happy warrior. That is grievance. That is anger. That is rage and all that stuff. I was thinking about, just one thing here. Like, I was thinking about Reagan when he ran 80-84. You didn't have to be a Republican who already agreed with him to like what he was saying. You could be apolitical or you could be minimally political, and he would come along and we talk about the need to be a stronger country, the restoration of confidence in America. And all of that, you know, was the sort of thing where you didn't. I feel like a lot of Republicans, when they run for president, yes, they're running in a Republican primary, but they basically begin a 10-step argument with the 10th step. They begin with the assumption that you already agree with all of the, we got to secure the border. They don't really go to, here's why we need to secure the border. Here's why we need low taxes. Here's what, I can see you smiling. So I don't know if this is catnip to you or you're like, they're
going. No, it's true. It's true. They've already closed the sale. You're driving the car off the lot. They didn't have to pitch you. And by the way, that doesn't work. That's why I actually watched Ronald Reagan in 1978 campaigning for president in California after he lost. I watched Gerald Ford. I was on the Ford campaign as a college kid in 76. Even when they were fighting, they weren't fighting. They were happy. And then even in 78 through 80, when they were all fighting, I was a John Connolly guy. As my friend Judy Frank says, Hugh, you're always wrong. And I am always wrong about primaries, but that's why I don't pick anymore. You're always wrong. And I always pick the happiest person. Usually I picked Mitt Romney in 2008. He was the happiest person running because I like happy. So after Tim Scott, who's the next happy warrior on the list? Because I do think your column is right. There is a lane for happy.
You could go through all over again. I think.
Well, let me go through them. Abbott, I'll tell you this way: on a scale of 1 to 10, with Donald Trump being the least happy and Tim Scott being the 10, give us a number. Greg Abbott.
All right. 7, 8, something. He's pretty good.
Chris Christie.
4 or 5, and he's past his window, and I'm getting annoyed. Has Christie appeared on your program, Hugh?
Many, many times.
Okay, so have you noticed, like, in the last 3 years, if you ask him, he'll say, well, let me tell you what's wrong with Ron DeSantis, you know, and he'll go, he doesn't have enough personality and all that kind of stuff. He'll go down the list and he'll rip into every other potential Republican. And it's as if he's waiting for the person to say, gee, Governor Christie, well, I guess if everybody else is so flawed, I guess you'd better run.
Well, let me play you a clip of Chris Christie. Two days ago, Chris Christie said this, cut number 21.
Better have somebody on that stage who can do to him what I did to Mark. Because that's the only thing that's going to defeat Donald Trump. And that means you got to have the skill to do it. And that means you have to be fearless. Because he will come back and right at you. And so you need to think about who's got the skill to do that and who's got the guts to do it. Because it's not going to end nicely.
Jim Garrity, that's like the WWE promotion right there. That's Chris Christie in New Hampshire, his first visit to New Hampshire, saying it's not going to end nicely. You got to have someone to go after Trump, who, like I went after Marco.
All of that is correct in theory, but all of us who have memories back to 2015, 2016 can remember, Christie was he really went after Rubio. He took him to school on that debate stage, and then he endorsed Trump.
I was in the ABC News green room for this week when he did that and got an email from Meg Whitman, who was angry with Chris Christie. Let me go down my list. Ron DeSantis, 1 to 10.
If he jumps in, my fear is that Chris Christie does the same thing again, where he decides, I want to be the anti-Trump thing. I'm going to go really after Ron DeSantis. I am going to tear into Ron DeSantis. I'm going to call him a bore. I'm going to call him a stiff. I'm going to say he's not tough enough so that I can get to that one-on-one. And then we end up with the one-on-one, and then Christie goes up against Trump and doesn't win.
All right.
And then
I'm back to happy lane. Ron DeSantis, ranking.
I'd like to see sunnier and cheerier. He's got the record to do it. So I'm going to put him around a 6 or a 7. Could get higher.
Larry Elder.
I just want to see him campaign.
Host Larry Elder, who's running.
I don't take him that seriously, Hugh. He's not going to like that, but
I have no opinion on whatever you say. He's going to run. I don't know if he gets on the stage. Nikki Haley, happy.
She's up there, 7 or 7.5, let's say.
Mike Pence.
6. Just a lot of baggage there.
Mike Pompeo.
5, but he's kind of entertaining in the way that he's grouchy.
Vivek Ramaswamy.
Again, I don't take him seriously. The presidency is not an entry-level job.
Tim Scott.
Stop running for Fox News gigs.
Tim Scott.
Oh, 10. 10.5. Right. 11.
Chris Sununu.
Maybe an 8. But unfortunately, that I think there's an argument that he's running in the John Weaver-advised Republican who don't like Republicans lane, which is not a strong
then
lane.
Then we have the last two, Trump and Youngkin. Donald Trump and Glenn Youngkin on the scale of 1 to 10.
Well, I mean, Trump's negative infinity. And Youngkin's about a 9, but he seemed adamant that he doesn't want to run. You know, which my guess is that Youngkin is just watching everything. And if it turns into a demolition derby and everybody's damaged and everybody's conceivably, maybe Youngkin jumps in at the last minute. But I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that scenario.
That's why we have Garrity on. But go track down Gallagher and do a podcast with him just on the Jets Packers. Because everybody needs to help the Jets get out of the basement. Everybody's got to pitch in. And the Browns did their part this week. Garrity, the indispensable. Follow him at Jim Garrity online. Follow him at the National Review. Read him in the Washington Post. Thank you, James. Stay tuned, America. Welcome back, America. Olivia Beavers is the Politico correspondent who covers Congress, and she joins me most Wednesdays. Good morning, Olivia. How are you?
Hi, Hugh. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm great. Olivia, do you do a podcast for Politico on Inside Congress? Because I hope you do.
I don't, actually. You're sort of my weekly talk about Congress, conversation that I do.
I think you'd be good at this because I was reading your last two pieces on the internal maneuverings within the Republican caucus on the border bills and on other subjects and they're very in-depth. They're inside baseball. Last night I was listening to a baseball podcast called Terry Talking about the Cleveland Guardians with David Campbell, their sports editor, and it was superb. It was 5-star because it was explaining the background. I mean, deep dives. I want to know, how did they sign Andrés Giménez for 7 years with an 8-year option? Why did they do it? And they got into the nitty-gritty the way that you did in your last two pieces. And I think if you found the right interlocutor, this is fascinating stuff to me. The Chip Roy, Tony Gonzalez stuff. Use that as an example. Explain that to people.
Yeah, so right now we're seeing basically the conference is trying to rally behind an internal GOP measure and plan to address the border security. But what you're finding is that two Texas Republicans, Chip Roy and Tony Gonzalez, who are sort of on the opposite ends of the political spectrum, are fighting it out in public in a kind of wild way. And, you know, my understanding is that there's some personal reasons for this. It's turned into bad blood, but now it's also just connected to policy. And so Tony Gonzalez is saying, I have the most border land in my district than anyone else, and I'm not going to be bending. And Chip Roy's bill is going to be marked up in judiciary. And basically, Gonzalez is saying, I'm not going to support it. And if they bring it to the floor, I'm going to be joined by others who are going to basically nuke it. So leadership can decide if we're going to move forward with this or if they're going to work with me. And I know he's meeting with Mark Green, chairman of Homeland Security, this week. He's been meeting with leadership. But basically, this is sort of the reality of the small majority is pulling them all together. And, you know, usually when you ask Republicans or members of Congress generally for comments, they're going to try to go on background to not give you a quote jabbing one of their colleagues. But here, you can see them both taking shots at each other in the media. So that's kind of where they're at.
You also mentioned Chip Roy's on rules. And so rules actually decides what goes to the floor. And I began thinking about it. And that's why I want to go back to my podcast. The last thing you need is more work, right? But a genuine podcast between fair-minded umpires of what's actually going on. And are you a baseball fan, Olivia?
I can play softball, but I wouldn't say I watch it.
All right. Then it will be perfect for you. The Terry's Talking podcast last night is a deep dive into details that only long experience and inside knowledge and shoe leather gives you. Mm-hmm. People don't understand Congress at all. Do you agree with me? They don't understand how it works.
They don't. I also feel like the culture of how things are when the cameras are off, when you're just sort of talking to people. I mean, there's a lot of sort of joking around and kind of, making jabs with lawmakers that I do, where I'm kind of throwing jokes at them and they're throwing jokes at me. I have members who call me loser as a joke when they walk by, and it's all in good fun. But that's not really what you sort of expect when you watch some of the movies about what it's like covering Congress. And so it's a very different sort of scene in my mind. And, you know, a lot of they're regular people too. They have weird stories. You see them do weird things and you don't always tweet about it. You don't always report it because that's how you maintain people talking to you.
All right. If you named your podcast In Session and you only did it on days when they're actually in session, so I don't like make you work 365 days a year. Who would you pick if you got to draft anyone at Politico to work with to do In Session as a podcast where you talk about what's going on in Congress? Who would you pick?
So it's between two people. My colleague, Sarah Ferris. So she's well-sourced with House Democrats. My strength is House Republicans. And she's very good on policy. But then I also like my colleague, Burgess, who is sort of the king of understanding the Senate. And pulling him in, he has a huge array of sources. He's very talented in how he understands how Congress works. And so I'd love to pull him in.
Have they brought this to your attention yet? Anyone said, hey, Olivia, we want you to do a daily podcast?
I've had a few people talk to me about it, including internally. So I don't think it's off the table, but I don't want to get ahead or do anything.
I'm putting this out there because In Session, the new name, Olivia Beter's new Politico podcast, In Session, co-hosted by Burgess and by the other colleague who I can't remember, will be debuting next week. I just thought I want to pin your ears to anything, but I just would listen to that every night. If it was just the gritty, neat, I love the details because some of us are tired of headlines. We get the headline, but the details. All right, Olivia, follow Olivia on Twitter, Olivia_Beavers, and listen to her new podcast, In Session. Sorry to do that to you, Olivia. Make sure they pay you more. Yeah, say, hey, look, I'll do that. Happy to do that, but you got to double my salary because I am a superstar. That's what you do, Olivia. That's how you negotiate from one person to another. Thank you, Olivia. Talk to you next week. Don't go anywhere, America. David Joyce is joining me next in next hour. He's the hometown congressman. He's an appropriator. He's from Ohio. He's from Geauga. Knows Ashtabula. Knows Warren. Represents Warren. We're going to find out what he's doing for Warren. You know, I believe in earmarks for Warren. That's my that's my whole agenda for an appropriator. Earmarks for Warren and everything else for defense. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. This is a special segment of the Hugh Hewitt Show because Pete Kaufman agreed to help me out with this. If you have been watching if you're a sentient human being, you have seen repeated ads over the last year for anyone who ever lived anywhere near Camp Lejeune, the Marine Corps base in southeastern United States, and it's repetitive and it's overwhelming. Well, I finally got a request from my brother-in-law to find a lawyer who knew what this was all about because he had a friend from the basic school in 1968 who may qualify for relief, and I didn't know how to find someone, so I called up Judge Larson, my go-to guy in L.A. I said, who will help out a former Marine if they've got a legit claim on this Camp Lejeune thing? I never call a TV lawyer. He immediately said, call up Pete Kaufman. Pete is with the Panish firm in L.A., Panache, Boyle, and Rivipoldi. And you can find that over at www.psbr.law. All right, psbr.law. Pete Kaufman joins me this morning. Good morning, Pete. Thank you for getting up early to talk to me.
Yeah, sure thing.
Pete, would you explain what you did to me, the genesis of all of these ads, because when they weren't there a year ago, now they're everywhere. What is this all about? What's going on?
Well, the reason people are seeing ads is that in August of 2022, the Camp Lejeune Justice Act was signed into law by President Biden, and the law gives people who were exposed to drinking water at Camp Lejeune between 1953 and 1987, the right to file a lawsuit against the government claiming that they were injured because of contaminated water. Before that act, that right largely didn't exist. And so that started the interest that you're seeing now. And then the lawyer ads sort of just follow suit.
Yeah, the August 2022 law, what does it allow people to claim and what's the process that people have to go through? Because I have had a lot of people mention to me, what is this all about? And I really have no idea what happened at Camp Lejeune. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt never lived there. She lived on Quantico and Pendleton, but not there. So I don't really have a good idea what the claims are and what the bottom line is here.
Well, so first let's talk about the claims. From 53 to 87, it's possible that people who were stationed at Camp Lejeune or working there as civilian employees were exposed to contaminated water. For years, because of various base activities, industrial activities, storage of fuel, and dumping of toxins, notably by an off-base dry cleaner, contaminants like perchloroethylene and trichloroethylene, benzene, vinyl chloride, leached into the groundwater, and the water system at Camp Lejeune is fed by a series of wells. And so the contaminants would be pumped up by the wells and put into the water system, and then you'd be exposed to it by consuming it or by bathing in it, because those compounds can volatilize when they're in hot water. So the contaminants are linked to various forms of cancer. And for years, there had been complaints made by folks who'd been stationed at Camp Lejeune. And before the 2022 Act, they would make claims against the Department of Veterans Affairs or the VA administration. In 2012, an act was passed, the Camp Lejeune Act, which just provided for claims against the Veterans Administration. The 2022 Act is different. It requires people who want to make a claim to first make a claim against the government. So you make a claim against the Department of the Navy and say, I was at Camp Lejeune from this date to this date, and now I've been diagnosed with a condition, and I think that condition was caused by the contamination. If the Department of the Navy rejects the claim, and it's thought that the Department of the Navy will reject most, if not all of them, then you have the ability to sue the government in federal court, in one federal court in the Eastern District of North Carolina. That's what the 2022 Act provides for, and that process has now started, although it's started sort of in fits and starts.
Well, that's what I learned from you when I talked to you. And by the way, for the benefit of the audience, I don't know Pete. He's not a sponsor of the show. He specifically said he's not looking for clients when he did this. I just asked him to please explain why we have these ads. There is no unified litigation, right? This isn't like the opioids case brought by a state attorney general. It's not like big tobacco defending cases. It's not like Fen-Phen. This is different. Would you explain that to people, what why this is so ubiquitous and why it's just unusual for a situation, for a mass tort situation?
Well, I guess the principal difference would be, unlike the opioid litigation or tobacco or Fen-Phen, in those cases, you can have cases in federal court, you can have cases in state court, you can have consolidation in federal court, and so actions from all over the federal judiciary can be sent to one judge for pretrial discovery, and then they can be sent back after that pretrial discovery is done, and so you get a huge system involved in handling the claims. And even under those circumstances, those cases can take years. In the Camp Lejeune cases, the Camp Lejeune Justice Act, the act from last year, provides for one federal court, so the Eastern District of North Carolina, and that federal court doesn't have the ability to send the cases anywhere else. So you have sort of two bottlenecks that the act has created. One, everybody's got to first file a claim, so all of the claims have to go through the Department of the Navy tort claims process, which is not a very big office. And because the class period is so big, from 53 to 87, potential claimants number, and I've seen estimates of more than a million. So that's an extraordinarily high number of litigants who are then forced through this bottleneck at the Department of the Navy. When the Department of the Navy rejects those claims and those people then have standing to sue, they go to another bottleneck, presumably, in the Eastern District of North Carolina, and litigate their claims against the Department of Justice.
Have any of those cases gotten remotely close to being adjudicated yet, Pete Kaufman?
No. So, in fact, the earliest filed cases after the 2022 Act were dismissed, and the court's reasoning was, while these litigants had had a claim that was rejected by the Department of the Navy, it was rejected before the Act was passed. So the judge read the Act literally. So not a claim rejected ever, but a claim rejected after August of 2022. So everybody started over. So now you're waiting for a rejection after the Act was passed, and you're waiting on an office that, by all accounts, is understaffed and overwhelmed.
So, Pete, when I sent my brother-in-law's inquiry to Judge Larson, he forwarded it to you. We had a long conversation about the merits of it. And how are you assessing claims that are rolling into you? And with a million litigants, there's going to be a best claim and a worst claim, right? There's going to be someone who really did get sick because of the water. And there's going to be someone who said, maybe there's a judgment fund out there and I can grab some quick thought. How are you assessing people who ask you to represent? And again, I have no connection to Pete, never met him, never dealt with the Panish firm. I'm retired from the law. I got no interest in this other than it's ubiquitous and strange and everyone sees the ads. So how do you, as a lawyer who has to win, you don't want to lead people on, how do you assess the claims?
Well, so the way that I've handled it is to look back at the studies that have been done. So what science do we have available? The Camp Lejeune situation is a pretty sad story. We now know that the contaminants were there in the groundwater for a long time, and they were only found in 1982 because of routine water testing. And then there were several years of testing by scientists who worked for the government or who were hired by the government. And that science sort of developed into a picture that exposure to these contaminants, TCE, PCE, vinyl chlorides, and benzene, are associated with particular forms of cancer. So notably, the ones where we've got very good evidence are adult leukemia, aplastic anemia and other myelodysplastic syndromes, bladder, kidney, and liver cancer, multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Parkinson's disease. So if you were at Camp Lejeune for 30 days or more, so that's the time period that's identified in the Act, if we're talking about real causation, the longer the exposure period, the greater the risk, and you've been diagnosed with one of those conditions, the science is at least strong that there's a connection. It doesn't mean that your condition was absolutely caused by that exposure. It means that there's evidence of an association. Those are the cases that I'm looking at hardest. I want to prove someone was at Camp Lejeune, so that's easiest for an active duty Marine or his or her family members. It's a little harder for civilian employees, and it's hardest of all for people who say they were there for some other reason. But first, you've got to demonstrate exposure. That's what the Department of the Navy is going to look at. And then a diagnosis of one of those conditions. Now, when you see the ads, the list of injuries is much, much longer. And there may be some basis for that. But the longer that list gets, the lower level of confidence, at least as far as I'm concerned, demonstrate an association.
Stop right there. We'll continue talking with Peter Kaufman after the break. Welcome back, America. My guest is Peter Kaufman with the Panish firm in L.A. I want to finish the conversation about why are you seeing a Camp Lejeune ad for potential litigants everywhere? They're ubiquitous. Why are you doing that? I turned to Pete Kaufman, the Panish firm in L.A. on the recommendation of my old law partner, Judge Larson and Robert C. O'Brien. Back to that. Now, Pete, I tell everyone, never hire a lawyer off of a TV ad. I've said that for 40 years. I'm retired now, and so I don't have to do this anymore. But never hire. Don't call the 800 number. That's going to take you to an intake filter. You've got to find someone who knows what they're doing. Will there emerge? This is really my last question. Will there emerge lead counsel here so that this is not, I mean, this looks like it's an explosion of litigation. I'm not sure how this ever gets to an end.
Well, so as an attorney, that's what I'm waiting for. We don't have a system in place to set up that leadership like you would have in a multi-district litigation. So that's a federal action where a panel in Washington, D.C. has ordered all of the cases to be before one judge. In that process, the judge is most concerned at the beginning in setting up that leadership. Well, the court in the Eastern District, and this is not a criticism, but they're dealing with a one-of-a-kind litigation where you're going to have a number of plaintiff's counsel that is larger than the number of litigants in some cases. And it would make sense eventually for the judge to say, you know, make applications to be part of the leadership and I'm going to appoint somebody. That might happen. It just hasn't happened yet. So you have enormous interest. You've got you've got a huge group of advertising lawyers or money that wants to be in the case acquisition business, and the result is what you see.
And so any idea how long we'll be seeing the ads for, Pete Kaufman? Because they are ubiquitous and they're driving me crazy.
Yeah, so I don't know. Here's what I can say. They'll probably go down, but they could certainly ramp back up as soon as they're in, you know, as soon as there's any kind of a development. The earliest developments are a judge who's, it looks like, being careful and is interpreting the act conservatively. Eventually, I think there will be leadership. Eventually, we'll get a sense of what the Justice Department is going to do about these cases. But, I mean, it can come at us in waves. You can have a good deal of interest at the very beginning, which wanes as the litigation sort of drags. And then you'll get a rumor of, well, the Justice Department's going to pay all these claims. And then it'll be just
spikes,
as bad as before.
Right. Well, it is just everywhere. It's literally in the water and it's figuratively in the water. And Pete Kaufman, I appreciate your talking to me this weekend to explain it to me and then getting up early to explain it to the audience, because everybody knows what we're talking about. Because even people don't watch TV have somehow heard about this, and that's the backstory. Pete Kaufman is with the Panish firm. If you want to read up on his bio, it's psbr.law, psbr.law. Thank you, Pete. I appreciate it very much.
Sure, thank you.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.